Banking has, since the beginning of the Republic anyway, been a divisive issue. Well, now we have it. But that's another show. If you are like most people, me included, you feel you really have no choice when it comes to getting a loan. But there is another way. And it doesn't involve going into debt or being at the whim of a banker's policies or fees or market fluctuations. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 191.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here.
Luke Tatum returns to the show. Luke and I are talking about being your own banker. It is an interesting concept and one that is sure to challenge the conventional thinking of most folks. Hello! It is sound and it works, and this isn't the first time I've heard what Luke is going to talk about, but it is the first time it's made the most sense. Hello, Luke. Thank you for joining me today on the Culinary Libertarian Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure, as always.
Well, you're back. So it's been a long time. I have to check and see. I don't know what the last episode was, but we talked about my plate stuff and nutrition. And we also spoke, our first conversation was about how to anarchy.
Yes, that was a good time. I don't remember exactly what all we got into on that conversation, but it was a lot of fun. I do remember that.
Well, it's interesting because what we're going to do a little bit is springboard off of the idea of living with rules, but without rulers, at least as much as is possible. Before we dive into that, some things in your life have changed, mostly what it is you're doing and where you're doing it, and you don't have to volunteer the second part, but remind the folks who you are and what it is that you're up to these days.
Sure. So, name is Luke Tatum. I am the CEO of Perfect Spiral Capital. Was in the financial world previously. I have now started my own company, my own agency to do that. And so we've moved from the city, Dallas, Texas area, out to North Central Arkansas. We're living the homestead life to some extent, although that increases as time passes. We just got some baby chicks, and you may actually even hear those because they're just one room away from me. They're making all kinds of noise and taking dirt baths and all that stuff in a little pen inside the living room. So, you know, we're learning as we go. We really don't know much about gardening or raising animals or anything, but we have a support network out here, and it's, you know, so far so good.
Excellent. Now, I'm going to plug my, I may have told you about my friend in Kentucky, John Moody, he's on Facebook, a couple of other social media outlets, but he's big in helping with homesteaders just like you, and I'm sure you have people near you who can help. But for the folks listening, say, hey, homesteading sounds like something I think I want to do. John Moody is on Telegram and on Facebook, and he's a big, big help, knows a lot of stuff.
Okay, perfect. So I will keep him in mind.
That's enough of that diversion. So you're here to talk a little bit about finance. And since we talked about, we sort of teased it with anarchy, what does finance and anarchy look like? How do we get control of our cash, make more of it, hopefully, and do that without Big Brother, or at least with as minimum exposure to Big Brother as possible? I think that's the goal. So anybody who's either driven a car and gone to the grocery store or driven a car to the grocery store knows that pain is the name of the game right now. I just noticed today in my town, On I think on Monday, gas was $4.43. Now it's $4.59 at the same place. It's like, holy smokes. The bargain store for groceries isn't a bargain anymore. Where it used to, $40 used to fill three bags. Now $40 fills half of one bag. Everybody's seeing this. So,
right.
Can we discuss a little bit first about just, this is a whole book of stuff, but from as you see it in your position as the CEO of your company, what's the state of finances and economics in the world? And let's talk about how people can hedge. It seems like the wrong word, but I guess that word, how people can hedge against that a little bit.
Sure, sure. Obviously, big question, right? And you may have to rein me in because I tend to get rambling and just kind of keep rambling and try to be
careful
about that. and I appreciate the platform for sure. But, so I don't even know if I'll go into global economic stuff because that may really just take us all day. But within the U.S., I mean, certainly, I think we can talk about the inflation that we're seeing as being a result of something other than what we are being told it is a result of. I don't think that anyone can really draw a causal relation from now there's a war in Ukraine to now prices are higher in the United States. I mean, there's been attempts in certain articles online, but does it actually make any sense? If you sit there and you think through this, you know, Rothbard would maybe have done some armchair logic on this subject and just thought through, okay, does that equal this? Does that equal this? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do that, I think what you run into is we had stimulus checks, we are doing corporate welfare. And when I say we, of course, I mean the United States government. I don't mean me. I don't mean you. But the United States government is throwing money at all kinds of problems, as it does, and more money as time goes on in larger and larger quantities. It's almost exponential how much money is being spent on things. And that money doesn't all just come from tax dollars, right? There's no tax receipts for the amount of funds that are being spent on these things. What you have is the creation of new money through various means, and we don't have to get super far into the technical details of that with buying treasuries in the Federal Reserve and everything. I'm happy to go into what you want to go into, but what's happening is that money is being created that wasn't there. That's the fractional reserve system. That's central banking. This all started in 1913 and really a little before that, but it's only gotten worse, and there's not really a check on that expansion of what I would call an evil system. So that's the reality that we live in now. You know, 100+ years after the Fed was created, these are the impacts that we have to deal with presently. And yeah, I mean, it's a bad time. If you're trying to stock up like we are, we're trying to homestead, we're trying to build a backlog of food supplies and things like that. I mean, that is a lot more expensive than it was going to be when we started this in November. And that's only been a few months.
Right. And so for the people who, there are people who listen who say, yes, I understand exactly what's going on, $8 trillion in the last couple of years. But for the folks who are listening who don't, it can't be, unfortunately, it can't easily be explained that this happened and this happened and this happened. But fundamentally, for the last 2 years of our lives, the people who can do this have pushed a button, created digital dollars, just Mary says poof, and they appeared. and so when new money enters into a system, there's a flow for that. And you and I and you, the listener, are the last ones to get it. By the time it gets to us, it has done things like drive prices up. So the how of all that is an entirely different show and probably somebody else's show. I'm trying to get somebody to do that, but that's another show too. There is, when we talk about things like what does it cost, the first thing that I think that question asks is, how much cash is that going to take from me for that thing? But there are other ways things cost. And one of those ways is time. If
yes,
time becomes a commodity, it's not a commodity, it becomes a thing you can spend, and you do spend it, but you can't spend it in two places at the same time. You can't be talking to me on a podcast and tending to the chickens. You can't be tending to the chickens and out tilling and rowing in the garden. So because people are interested in putting more time and effort into growing food to therefore can or freeze or put up in some way or another food, that's a cost. It's now becoming your time and labor has a value. And so that's another thing. I think that it's kind of a hidden cost in what is happening with this, with the inflation causing rising prices. It's just people are, I think Mises would say, different time preferences. And that's like, what does that mean? But it means that you're devoting more time to something secondary than first. First is go drive to the store and buy lots of cans of stuff, except one, it's expensive to get to the store than to get home because you got to drive twice. And then the cans of stuff are generally going up. So we need a second best alternative because the first one isn't becoming economically feasible. So buying the ball jars you can use again and again and again. So anyway, that sort of makes the point anyway that in addition to prices rising, the preferences and uses of our time and where we put our labor changes. And that's, I think, also a really big struggle, I think, on the psyche, certainly of families, because not everything gets done at the same urgency because now other things have to happen. And I can't vacuum the floor every day because I've got to plant a garden to have tomatoes to put up tomatoes. It can be angering or frustrating if you let it. And so it's another show too to not let that happen. So, let's start with the things that is your specialty, which is finance, cash finance. For the people who are, like probably very many of us, struggling now to buy the food and buy the gas, maybe we're not going as far as we used to because we can't afford to get there. So, how does the family that is suffering, and I think that's probably the right word, find a way to save or invest? And it becomes like, what are you talking about? That's insane. I may as well fly to Greece. That's not going to happen. How, what can people do? Because their paychecks aren't going up. They got a 5% cost of living increase and inflation 17%. Thanks. So they're getting creamed. Is there some way you can think of that they can sort of think about, what do I do? Oh, I can do this. What can they do? I don't know. I have no clue.
Well, sure. And I'm glad you talked about time preferences and things like that, because in my book, I mean, where I'm at in my life now, I feel like the people with the longer time horizon are always going to do better than the people with the short time horizon. Maybe there is a circumstance where that's not true, right? Maybe if we're talking about the literal collapse of society, like the moment, the eve of the collapse of the U.S. empire or something, okay, maybe you need to have a little shorter time preference. But just generally speaking, if you're making longer term plans, you're considering a lot more factors than if somebody is just focused on, well, I need to find an investment, for example, that's going to earn me some return in the next 3 weeks. Well, first of all, what do you even buy that's going to have a 3 week turnaround? But second of all, I mean, your greatest ally is time when you're doing financial planning. Usually people are talking about retirement accounts, right? And you can't even touch that without a penalty until you're of a somewhat advanced age, right? So there's no point in talking to people about short-term gains whenever, you know, what people are gearing up for. Like, why do you care about short-term gains if what you're actually planning for is when you're 65, 67, 70 years old? There's a lot of a mismatch. And so your question was, what do people do in this environment? What do people do who are struggling to make ends meet, don't have a whole lot of financial resources, they're not tripping over stacks of dollar bills when they walk through their house? It's a question that has multiple answers, and certainly people are trying to push different answers, and maybe I'm one of those people. But I don't think that the answer is necessarily just put every single cent you can find into Bitcoin. I mean, right now, the day that we're recording this, crypto markets are shot. I'm not going to sit here and say crypto is gone forever or anything like that. I don't believe that. But is that necessarily the place to put your money when it's something that can be outlawed by the government? You know, like it has been in some countries. So I do question the complete, total, all-in crypto advice. The advantage of crypto is that you can buy it at any price, basically. You can put in tiny, tiny amounts of money into it. So there is that. But what I recommend to people is that rather than sitting there and saying, okay, I have 5% of my total income that's disposable, what do I do with it? That's not how I have conversations with people. We talk through their total financial picture, and we talk about, okay, how much money do you need on an ongoing basis? How much money are you spending currently? What is it being spent on? Sometimes we make some tweaks to those things. And oftentimes we can find some money that can go into something liquid, that's usable again. And so it's not, oh, how much should I contribute to my 401k? And if you want to talk about retirement accounts more, I'm happy to do that because I hate them. But, you know, it's like money that you're going to use again. You know, you put money into a bank account because you anticipate taking it back out to spend it on something, right? I mean, bank accounts, savings accounts, especially in the last few years, are paying like 0.5%. You know, it's an embarrassingly low amount of return on just having money sitting there. And so why would you do that? Well, you shouldn't, in my opinion. So what do you do instead? That's the money I'm talking about. So it's not, oh, what's the last 5% of your income? It's what can you set aside knowing that you'll be able to use it again in a few weeks? And what is a better place to store and accumulate your wealth than a bank? Because, you know, the advantage of a bank is it's convenient. And they're going to pay you, if it's in savings, and if you don't spend the money, they're going to pay you 0.5% interest. The advantage of what I do is that you can use effectively the same dollars multiple times. And I mean, that's just, it sort of looks like wizardry the first time when you first start exploring the idea, but that's what it is. You know, if my monthly expenses are $3,000 for my household, then I can use $3,000, put it back into the policy. This is a policy that we'll talk about. And then next month I can take the same $3,000 back out and use it and put it back in. And so like, I still have to furnish this from income that I have on an ongoing basis. It's not a magic product that creates new money. It's not fractional reserve, you know, fiddling. There's nothing dodgy about it once you actually understand what's going on. But it's just a different place to put your money. And because the same dollars are always in there, if I take $3,000 out, it's technically a loan. Your base, your original amount that you're putting in, grows forever. So compounding, the most powerful instrument, the most powerful thing in the financial world, uninterrupted compounding, that's what's happening in here. You put $3,000 in, soon you'll have $3,500. Soon you'll have $4,100. Soon you'll have 5,000, etc., etc., just from doing the same thing every month. So that's, I mean, you know, that opens up a whole lot of things, but that is what I propose, and that is my suggestion. And, you know, it's worth saying, go ahead and invest in the stock market. Go ahead and buy crypto. Go ahead and do gold and silver and all those other things. My suggestion is just that before you do those things, it should go into one of these policies to get the advantages of the uninterrupted compounding and to take advantage of time, which you're not getting to do in the regular banking system.
And you're not printing your own dollars.
And you're not printing your own dollars. And that's maybe my favorite part.
All right. I think that there's a good possibility. I know what you're talking about. And there's a good possibility that some of the listeners are saying, I don't know what he's talking about. So you go ahead and explain the thing you're talking about and who invent, I don't know if that's the right word, but certainly came up with this idea. Talk about him a little bit and then how you're being involved in this. And then maybe some of that will make sense to the people.
Sure, sure. And, you know, and again, to anyone listening, I appreciate taking the time to sort of go through this because it is a total shift in the way that you think about money. And my argument is the way that you think about money now was taught to you by the banking establishment. So what I do, it's a special way of structuring a dividend paying whole life insurance policy. And so all sorts of objections pop up. You know, Dave Ramsey tells me that whole life is the worst possible thing. Susie Orman hates whole life. X and Y other radio personalities hate it. There's this YouTuber that I watch that, you know, can't stand them, whatever people you're, you know, getting your financial advice from. A lot of people hate whole life. And, you know, maybe there's a coherent argument to that if you're just talking about, okay, I need life insurance. What is the cheapest way to get it? Well, whole life is not that. But the way that I think about it is you're buying a banking system. You are replacing the commercial banking world in your life with this, and typically we're not talking about one policy, we're talking about multiples, 20 in some cases, but at least, you know, two or three or four. And so this system of policies is your banking world that you use, you know, the Tatum Family Bank for mine. And the more that you stop depending on commercial banks, the more that you kind of take this function over, you control what you might call the banking equation, that is where the power is. And as a bonus, there's a death benefit because it's life insurance, right? So when something happens to you, everyone eventually passes on. When that occurs, there will be a probably enormous death benefit that will go to your heirs. And you've gotten to use it for all of these other things for the entire time that you were alive. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of aspects to that, but this is something that I didn't know about for a long time, and I just happened to hear the great economist Robert Murphy, probably the greatest economist currently alive, in my opinion. I heard him on a podcast talking about the infinite banking concept, and he talked about a book and a podcast that he does called the Laura Murphy Report, Laura Murphy Show. And this book, it's called Becoming Your Own Banker. It's by Nelson Nash, the great Nelson Nash. He passed away a few short years ago, and I had the very good fortune of briefly meeting him and getting his autograph and stuff at a public appearance. But this book, I mean, it's 92 pages long. It's short. It's simple. It's down to earth. It's a lot of like just kind of little metaphorical tales and things talking about the importance of, for example, if you own a grocery store, you can't let people steal peas off of your shelves and walk out the back door with them, right? If you do that, your business is going to go under. That's a way of illustrating concepts, you know, that help you understand the banking aspect of your life insurance. And it's just, it's charming. It's great. He's hilarious. And I became totally enamored with that. But reading that book, I also thought, well, what about this? What about that? I don't understand how that works. And it took me about 2 years, roughly, to actually wrap my head around everything, because I had this struggle between, well, this book is amazing. I love what it's saying. He's anti-taxation, anti-Federal Reserve. You know, he has all the right impulses. The recommended reading section in the back of Becoming Your Own Banker is full of wonderful, wonderful Austrian thinkers and just excellent material. And then on the other hand, I have this like, well, but that's not what I know to be true based on my life experience and based on the savings account that I've had, the debit cards that I use, the 401k that I had at that time, et cetera, et cetera. I haven't been trained to think this way. And so for me, I would say that the learning is much easier than the unlearning. You have to sort of say, well, why is this wrong, the way that I have been doing things? And even now, I mean, I reread Becoming Your Own Banker every year, and I learn something new every time, because you just start to see the world a little differently. And Nelson's goal, you know, was to end dependence on the current commercial banking world, and to just establish a sort of financial liberty in each family that he could impact with that, right? But you asked a little bit about Nelson and his history and all that. He was from the forestry industry, and before he got into life insurance. And so as a forester, he's talking about, you know, what is the yield of your land going to be in 45 years and things like that. So he got this very, very long-term thinking that he started to apply to other areas of his life. And one day he just realized, hey, there's this really, really old financial tool called a whole life insurance product. It's over 250 years old. And so way older than the tax code and the Federal Reserve and all of that stuff. All those are newfangled inventions, you know. It's this thing that people use to save money for 200 plus years. And then in 1913, you have bankers coming in and starting to unlearn that from people and teach them this new, like, oh, hey, sign up for a savings account. So bankers would go into public schools and they would say, you know, hey, you're 6-year-old kids, let's get you a savings account here at the local bank. And they started to sort of craft this, you know, it's weird, but it's also kind of suspicious now that I think about it. Because, you know, every town you go to, little bitty towns especially, you go to the local soccer complex and local softball fields and all those things, and they all have bank signs all over them, right? Because they're all doing this PR work with the schools. And if you have a negative opinion of public education, which I know I do, and you look into the history of public schooling and all those things, like, it's a perfect match. The banking establishment that controls all of this evil stuff that goes on in the world, hates inflation and all those things, like, some of those same people are involved with public schooling being mandatory and some of the curricula that's taught in there. And I mean, you can draw links to all sorts of things, not to turn this into a conspiracy show, but you know, you look at big pharma and you look at the big banking system, you look at the education, and you look at all of that together, it sort of forms this web of, this is what we want you to think, and this is how we want you to think. And so this is just one little aspect of that. It's understanding that pretty much what the government says is a lie, and that also applies to money. And they sit there and push you into 401ks, and they make it, you know, required now under the SECURE Act to for employers to enroll everybody in the 401k plans and set a minimum amount of your paycheck that's going to go to those that increases each year, et cetera, et cetera. Why would they be doing that if it's such a good idea? Because when's the last time the government was making stuff mandatory that was really good for you? You know, it starts to make you skeptical.
Nothing they do is good for you. It's good for them.
Right.
You know, so I have a kid in softball, and I was thinking, what are the signs on the fence? And most of those are local businesses, which is good. Sure. I mean, that's fantastic. A lot of the local businesses are supporting the teams on the Little League, and that's fantastic. But it got me thinking that I recently just took both of my kids to a credit union, so to plug them in the system. And now there's a couple of interesting things. The first thing is, it's scary easy to do, which they've probably done on purpose. And as the way the world is going with electronic communication and transaction, one of my kids is nearly 16. She's learning how to drive a rolling bullet, so she can, you know, so it's time to learn how to manage digits and manage your impulses, because you can't keep buying earrings. So there is a real need to understand how, I hate the word money because it's not money, how cash works, even if it's digital cash. You have to understand, you have to learn to manage impulses. You can't spend, you can't buy, because the numbers aren't going to let you do that. You're not the federal government.
Right.
You can't do, was it $30 trillion? So
yeah,
there is a real world application to having an account within the system. So it's kind of a tough thing. You have to learn to do it. You're gonna be on your own. You need to pay bills, and that's the way you do it. I wanted to ask, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this question. Did you say infinite banking concept? You did. Is that
sure? Yeah.
Can minors participate, or do you have to be a legal adult?
Well, so anyone that's a legal adult can own life insurance policies. Your daughter cannot own a life insurance policy yet. It actually varies by state what the minimum age is to be a life insurance policy owner. And so it may be 16, it may be 18. We can always look into specifics on that. I believe there's one state that's 21, so that's an interesting exception. But you don't have to be the owner in order to get the benefits, because you're in a household, right? You're living together, seeing each other frequently. If you have just one policy, anyone in your household can use it. You just have to be the one, the owner has to be the one that logs in and types in how much money they want to get out. So if it's a, hey, I'd like $100 to buy earrings, then okay, cool. I'll get the $100 for you. It'll be in our bank account tomorrow. You still want to have some commercial banking presence so you can use a debit card, because life insurance policies don't have debit cards. But you get the $100 in the account, you spend it, and then this is a great thing to teach financial discipline kids, because there's an interest rate on that policy loan, okay? So if they don't have the money, the longer that loan is out, the more interest they're going to owe. And there's a certain sense in which they're paying it back to your policy, but technically what's happening is they're paying the interest back to the insurance company. The reason that this works the way that it does, not to get us too far into the weeds, is that the money that you put into this policy never leaves. The cash value that's listed is accessible through a policy loan or a surrender. You can surrender your policy, but I don't recommend that in most cases. You take a policy loan, it's going to have a 5% annual interest rate or something close to that in today's interest rate world. And, you know, so if it's out for a couple of days, you'll have a couple of dollars of interest or something, maybe less than that. And then when you pay it off, your loan is gone, everything's great. But the policy loan is money that the insurance company gives you. The collateral is the money that's compounding continuously inside your policy. So that's where you get uninterrupted compounding, and you can spend that money at the same time. Sometimes whole life is called an and asset, because you get, in any other type of asset, you would have compounding growth or you spend the money, you know, compounding growth or whatever. In this case, it's compounding growth, and you can use it on other things. So, I mean, you can buy investments and your investments make money, and then you have more money to put in your policy. And so it can accelerate very, very quickly. I have an article coming out in a couple of weeks that will kind of walk through that. Like, let's talk about buying a stock investment with cash versus buying a stock investment with a policy loan, and which one of those is better. So, you know, it, to me anyway, every time I run those numbers, it's surprising how much more effective it is to loan the money out of a policy. But for your daughter, I mean, I would just say, hey, cool. You're the banker. You can set the interest rate. The interest rate is going to be 5% from the insurance company, but you could call it 10. Okay, hey, you've got a 10% interest rate on this. So if she's already got the money, she wants to pay it off right away, great. But if she doesn't, then that's an excellent parent-daughter opportunity right there to talk about the price of buying things you can't afford. Because if it takes a year to pay that off, well, okay, that's going to accrue some interest.
Right. We've tried to... No, I'm not a complete dolt about finances and the system, but sometimes kids can ask a question that can be a really difficult answer for a 10 or a 16-year-old brain to comprehend. It's like, wow, you asked a really good question, and I'm struggling to give you an answer that you'll get. And one of those questions is, why do they charge interest? Well, there's an easy answer, and maybe there's a complicated one, and only people like you really care about the complicated one. But we've tried to have these, having a conversation about sound money management is like having a conversation about healthful eating. Well, one, healthy doesn't really mean anything anymore. We nailed that on the Food Plate show. But even still, people say healthy, and they have a very, very wrong idea in their heads about what healthy is. You sort of have to get into the thing to understand what it means to spend responsibly, because it doesn't make any sense. Drink responsibly. You want to talk about being a painter? Well, you can talk about it. You can read every book about Cezanne there is. But you're not going to know a damn thing about painting until you put brush in your hand and stand in front of a canvas. Like, oh my gosh, this is really hard. I mean, it's throw paint up there. Now make it look like something. That's two separate issues. And Jackson Pollock, it ain't as easy as he made it look. So I think that's a really valuable point, that there's a way for – now here's the thing. There's a way for the dialogue between the parent and the child, and I'm willing to bet that as that conversation grows, the adult's going to get a whole lot out of that too. I didn't realize Nash's book was only 97 pages, but it's like, wow. I haven't read it, and now I'm thinking, 97 pages, I can do that in a red light, so I might have to get it.
Well, and there's charts of numbers in that book too, Dan. I mean, it's not even, you know, just under 100 pages worth of text. It's probably 80 pages worth of text, and then there's huge life insurance illustrations in it. So it's a very fast read.
It's interesting. And so I think when we went, and I didn't know, when we got our life insurance policy back, I don't even know how many years ago, I had never heard of any of these people. I didn't know who Tom Woods or Bob Murphy was. I certainly didn't know who Nelson Nash was. And it never occurred to me, and I did know who Dave Ramsey was, and he probably said, don't do that. So I don't even know if it's possible. I don't even know what I have. I just know that twice a month we send somebody some cash. to start a policy that can be used as an IBC policy, can it be as simple as $100, or is it going to be more? Do you have to have a pretty good nut to start this thing?
So it depends on who the insured person is as to what the minimum budget is going to be. So life insurance companies are not in the business of charging you money that they don't have to charge you. is one way that to think about it. They look at actuarial data. They're looking at how likely it is based on, you know, law of large numbers, like the total population, like how young do people die, males versus females, smokers versus non-smokers, people who skydive versus non-skydivers, et cetera, et cetera. They're looking at risk factors, health conditions, things like that. And they're making an evaluation on your risk versus how much money is being applied for as a life insurance benefit. And that's where your premium comes from. So if you're, you know, 22, have no health conditions, and especially if you're female, then your premium is going to be extremely, extremely small. Now, the way that I do stuff is kind of backwards compared to the life insurance industry as a whole. So most of the time they're going to say, okay, how much life insurance do you need? And they'll run all these numbers and say, okay, it would take this much to pay off your house. It would take this much to provide your income to your spouse if something happened to you. It would be all this, blah, blah, blah. And it's this real big complicated analysis that spits out a number and it's like, hey, you need $1.7 million worth of life insurance. And that's not what I do. I ask people how much money they want to spend on a monthly, semi-annually or annual basis, and then I reverse engineer that budget to make it an efficient cash accumulation vehicle. There is going to be some minimum threshold. Like I'm not anticipating writing very many $5 a month policies. It's just silly right. at a certain point. But you know, if you've got $40, $60, $80, $100, something like that a month that you can work with, then it's probably worth having the conversation. Is it going to grow a lot better if you put in $1,000 a month? Yeah, of course it is. But doing something, you know, it's the whole adage of planting a tree, right? It's better to start doing it and to let the time factor do its thing, let the compounding start, you know, than not. If you wait 10 years to do it, then you're going to have the first year in 10 years, not the 10th year in 10 years. You know, the thing about compounding, like if you imagine, and this is not what the life insurance world can give you, but if you imagine an asset that doubled every year, you know, the last year when it jumps to $1 million, well, that's a really fantastic amount of growth. But the year before that, it was 500,000, right? So the very best year of growth is the last one. And that when you're talking about a life insurance product, the last year is when the insured person dies. But the best growth happens the furthest from when you start it. If you're 20 years old, you might have 80 years of compounding growth, right? If you start it when you're 65, you don't have 80 years probably. But you still have a lot more than if you wait till you're 75. So it's still, you know, the time factor is just something that I'm extremely conscious of. And whenever people are on the fence and they're talking about doing something for 2 or 3 years before they actually pull the trigger, it starts to make me think they're never going to do it, you know? And it's like, well, this would be a lot better if we had just already done it on some smaller scale.
Right. And so the idea that we use to open the show of time preference mm-hmm. for that 22-year-old is a whole lot better than it is for the 62-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. So can now speak just for myself. Is it maybe I already know the answer. I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there a way for me to start a policy in her name or for her, or does the person have to be a legal adult to do it?
No, people start life insurance policies on their 1-year-olds or, you know, technically 0-year-old kids all the time. That's a popular thing because then it's money that can be tapped into for college or what have you, whatever the goals are. Maybe so they can start their own business, buy their first car, or whatever. You pay some money in, you know, it is a financial sacrifice because you're sacrificing present satisfaction for the future. But by doing mm-hmm. that on a small scale, you have a lot more money than if you just wait until they're 16 to buy the car, wait until they're 25 to try to start the business, and then go, ha, where are we going to find $30,000, right? Mm. It's just planning ahead. And the best thing about it is the insurance company cannot tell you no when you want the money, right? That's one of the biggest distinctions to me. The world we live in now, if you want to finance something, you have to go hat in hand to the bank and say, please, Mr. Banker, if it's not too much trouble, I'd like to have $25,000 to buy this car or whatever. They're going to ask your income. They're going to ask how long it's going to take you to pay off the loan. They're going to really look into your stuff and try to figure out how viable this loan is. Because if we're talking about a car, they have to repossess the car if you can't pay, and then they have to try to recoup their money by selling the vehicle and all of that, right? The life insurance company does not care. They don't care at all. If the money's in your policy, they're going to give it to you. It says so in the contract. And the reason they'll do that is because the collateral is not a car, it's not a house, it's the death benefit. So if you die without ever paying that loan back, they'll just say, okay, you have a $500,000 death benefit minus $35,000 worth of outstanding loans. Here's the remaining amount for your beneficiary. It's just a subtraction problem. A computer does it. There's no labor. There's no uncertainty. It's the safest loan they could possibly make, period. And so that's where all this flexibility and stuff comes from. It's really cool.
All right. I'm going to ask you kind of a technical in the weeds question, because I was thinking about a show I listened to today, and it's Mike Maher's show,
sure.
The Gold Wrap.
I love him.
And he was talking about a couple of examples he'd read somewhere that a fellow was using stocks as the collateral at the bank to get cash to buy a house, and the stocks lost a substantial amount of the value, and this fellow's on the edge thinking that the bank's going to call him a note, like, dude, your collateral stinks. You can't support this purchase of this house anymore because your stocks are worth half of what they were when you came to us. And lots of people are seeing very similar kinds of things with that, where the asset now is just tanking.
Right.
Is the life insurance policy subject to the whims of market fluctuations and inflation?
On the first part of your question, no. On the second part, yes. So everything is subject to inflation. I'll circle back to that. But the market, it doesn't matter. It's what's called a non-market correlated asset, if you want to speak some financial jargon at folks. But it has nothing to do with the stock market. The primary thing that the insurance companies are investing in to generate the income they need to pay the death benefits when people pass away it's a number of things, but it's primarily bonds, very, very high-rated corporate bonds, sometimes municipal bonds, and then also the income from policy loans. Since they set the loan rate for people to access their funds, they kind of can adjust that as they need to. Many, many years ago, the loan interest rate for a policy loan might have been 8%. Right now it's 5. It's been 5 with the primary company that I work with for about 20 years. So, there's not a lot of risk there. But they're well-capitalized companies. They're not allowed to buy speculative investments. That's a legal thing. So feel about that how you will about that. But they're just not allowed to do anything extremely risky with the money. They must pay you whenever something happens to the insured person in the contract. Now, inflation, and I'm glad you brought this up, because basically every single person I talk to wants to know, well, what do I do about inflation? How do I hedge against inflation? Like you said before, is this going to protect me from inflation? And the answer is nothing is going to protect you from inflation. Having land, physical stuff, a source of food that you don't have to exchange money for, things like that are what will protect you from the effects of monetary inflation and price inflation. There is not a financial asset that is going to be immune from the financial world. It just doesn't, unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. So, you know, and if inflation is high, which it is, would you rather be getting 4, 4.5, 5.5, 6% compounding year over year, guaranteed not to decrease under any circumstances, period, inside of a policy? Or would you rather only the money that you don't spend earns 0.5% in your bank account at Bank of America or wherever? I mean, that's the question in my mind. Or would you rather put it in an asset that you can't have, which is a retirement account? If you need the money out of your 401k, you've got to pay income tax plus 10% unless you're already retirement age and you're probably already drawing out of it. So, and then of course, you have to sell out of your 401k when you reach 70 years old, 72 years old. This is evolving as they are changing the rules on it in the Secure Act legislation that just passed. But at a certain point, you must sell. It's called a required minimum distribution, or RMD. And even if the market is down like it is right now, you must sell. So you must sell at a loss a certain amount of your assets every single year once you hit that age. And so there's all kinds of strings attached that most people don't even know they're signing up for. And in my mind, those are the choices. Do you want a bank account, or do you want a 401k, IRA, Roth IRA? Or do you want something that you actually control that outperforms the bank?
Doesn't really seem like a challenging question.
Right.
Let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
But you know, there's some adage, I'm going to ruin it by not saying it correctly, but the devil you know. The banks, the system, everything that has been thrown at you. I guess I got that one right, actually. has been thrown at us is familiar and known, and our friends and relatives will say bad things to us if we do something that is outside the established and understood. This is just a sidelight to actually make a joke, but the new Ministry of Truth, what's her name? I don't know her name, but the one who had the TikTok Nina video and the really bad song. Yeah,
Nina, I don't know something. That's their last name. Yeah, Nina. Yep.
She wants to now turn Twitter into Wikipedia with editability to a tweet, so that the Ministry of Truth can supplement the content for clarification. And I thought of it and then forgot it. Just remembered that she's now taking the 3x5 card of allowable opinion, and she's changing it from inches into millimeters. But that's where everyone still is going to be stuck in it. A little teeny tiny postage stamp of, this is what you're allowed to do. This is the right thing. And I think probably your biggest battle is, convince is the wrong word, but at least breaking through that sort of white noise defense to show an alternative to the system. It's like, just look high enough and you'll see beautiful green pastures over there. But right now you don't see it. Right now you see Minneapolis in 2020, and there's a better way. And I admit that up until this point, I've heard Bob's show. Bob is so incredibly smart, and I'm not. So the show was just like way over. I was like, dude, I'm sorry. I know you're trying to teach guys like me. I'm not getting it. But you did a good job. You reached where he couldn't. So that was good.
I try to be an advocate for things that I have found that have improved my life. You know, that's sort of the way I operate in the world. And this is one of those things. You know, it's really easy for me to talk about it because we use it. I cannot believe even today, like how good this has been over the long term. There is a sunk cost up front. Like, you are buying life insurance. I mean, it's not that it's free and you just go to the bank and open up a free life insurance policy account where you put money. But once you, it took me forever because I'm a very slow sell. Once I find something that I really like, I really stick to it because I fully explore that. I think I inherited that from my father probably. But once it all clicks and I get it, Nelson Nash used to say IBC is more caught than it is taught. And I think that's a funny, cute way of saying, like, once it makes sense, once you get it, then the rest of it is easy. You know, he'll also say understand what's going on, you will know what to do. That's probably my favorite quote of his. And, you know, we're talking about IBC. And so let me, you know, back up 40,000 foot view for a second, if I can, and just say that, you know, it's IBC is what I first heard of. That is what it says on the cover of Becoming Your Own Banker. It's unlocking the infinite banking concept. I am not listed on the infinite banking website at this point or anything like that. So I'm not affiliated with the Nelson Nash Institute. I base everything that I do on that book and the other book that Nelson wrote, Building Your Warehouse of Wealth. But there are lots of people and lots of resources online that are doing something roughly the same. It's the same concept. Once you understand it, it's infectious. But they may call it privatized banking. They may call it all number of other things. But if it's a whole life policy used for quote unquote banking, that's what you want. And you know, you just want to make sure that the person who's doing that understands and can reference and recite sections from Nelson's book and sees that vision, because there is also something someone introduced me to called the Laser Fund, LASER, which is trying to basically do the bank on whole life kind of concept, but it's using universal life, and universal life is not a good product. Happy to say as much as you want on that, but I do not recommend universal life or any variation of that for this, because it is a risky asset. The point of this is to have safe returns, safe, predictable growth. The risk should be borne by the insurance company, and universal life does not do that. So just a word of warning to anyone. Like, I could sell universal life products if I wanted to. I do not want to, because it's not something that I view is in the best interest of essentially anyone.
Okay. And is it possible for you to become, I'm going to use the word that might be the wrong term, an affiliate for the Nash Institute or IBC? Is that a thing you can attain?
Sure. And I'm not sure what I'm really allowed to say at this stage. I've been talking to them and I'm working on being listed on their side. I want to be very hands off at this stage.
Sure.
Because I am not listed on their site, right? So I'm not making any claim explicitly or implicitly that I am a IBC practitioner, which is their official term that they use. So with that out of the way.
But this is a goal.
Right. Absolutely. Because that is where heart is. I align with that vision 100%.
Yeah, I'm not trying to put you in a jackpot, but I want for the listener who's saying, well, why is this guy talking about this? Is because you have a vision and you have a plan. And So that's good. Is this a U.S.-only thing?
Well, so different countries have different rules. There is possibility that it may be applicable to a large number of countries. I know that you can do this in Canada. And so, you know, they have different retirement accounts. They have different names for all these different things. So it's a little bit trickier. I'm not presently licensed in Canada, but I could seek that if I find someone who's wanting to go there. But within the U.S., it's as simple as just applying for another license in another state, you know. Right. So Canada is the only other country I know of.
Anybody in the U.S. listening to this who says this is something I want to pursue, they can reach out to you and you can help.
Absolutely.
And how do they do that? Reach out to you? How do people contact you?
You can go to my website, perfectspiralcapital.com. That is capital with an A, since we're talking about resources, not a state capital. But perfectspiralcapital.com, you can click the contact button. You can also just directly email me. It's luke@perfectspiralcapital.com. I'm also on all the social medias, you name it, pretty much every platform you can find me. It'll be at Luke Tatum or just Luke Tatum. I try not to use aliases because I am me. And if you have a vendetta against me, I'll just make it easy to find me.
Somewhere in the northern hills of Arkansas, so take your chances. It is Arkansas.
That's right. That's a whole conversation, man. We talk about the 50,000 acres of uninhabited wilderness south of us. That's some crazy territory out there.
I bet. I don't think you're much of a hunter, which isn't good or bad. What do you know lives in those woods? You got bear and wild boar, or anything that's sort of unique to that area?
There is bears here. There are bears here. I guess I should speak grammatically correct as much as I can. They, as far as I know, black bears, grizzly bears, there's actually crocodiles in some places, although I have not seen them. I'm not sure what part of the state that is, but they are in Arkansas. We have beautiful, you know, herons and things that fly around and land by our pond and stuff. Wild turkeys, deer, turtles. I saw a huge turtle just a few days ago. I thought I was about to see a bear for the first time because it was just like tearing through the woods. I mean, slowly, you know, but making so much noise going through the underbrush and stuff. I thought, what is going on? And I eventually looked over, saw the motion. It was just a turtle, you know, about as big as my back, probably. just dragging his way through the woods, down the mountain, basically. And yeah, I mean, we see deer all the time. We see all kinds of stuff out in the woods. But I have not seen a bear yet. I've not seen a crocodile or alligator or anything like that yet. There's elk, too. We haven't seen those yet.
Really?
So
yeah.
They're out west of us.
Not the crocodiles, but we have all those things here. And they don't know why, but this year, there's plenty of food. There's lots of rain, so there's stuff everywhere. There, I think it's a gray fox that I've seen in different neighbors' front yards. It was in my front yard the other day, and I'm assuming his gender. He's gorgeous, with a huge fluffy tail and just this beautiful fur. And we had seen a red fox in Tallahassee walking down the middle of the street at middle of the day, and this thing looked near death. I think there's the thing manged. This thing looked bad. So this fox here is just like, wow, he's just gorgeous. And urban deer, I think that's a problem everywhere, although again, maybe not urban, but we're urban. And like, I counted 9 just resting in someone's front yard the other day, like middle of the day. Oh, we're here eating. What are you going to do about it? Man, right, if I could, right. I'd be eating you.
And that's something that we'll probably get into more. Sorry to cut you off. It's, you know, we're looking at potentially bow hunting. We probably will trap squirrels, things like that, just to have some options. We're going to raise rabbits for meat. And, you know, that's all new territory for us. But the economic landscape, I think, kind of necessitates that we start to learn some of those skills. So, you know, and one other thing I should say, bald eagles, if you're into bald eagles, man, they are out here. They are beautiful. And, you know, they sound like little kittens. All the sound clips you hear in movies and stuff are fake. That's actually not an eagle sound. So look up what a bald eagle actually sounds like if you're interested in that. But they fly around and they sound like cats. It's wonderful.
They are very pretty birds. They're very majestic. And there's a couple of kinds of eagles here, and we've seen those. And just a big flying raptor is a fun thing to see.
Yep, yep.
All right. Well, I appreciate the time. And it's probably getting close to lunchtime where you are, so I'm going to let you go.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I always enjoy chatting with you. You know, sometimes recording is great, but we can always chat anytime. Welcome to, to give me a call and we can talk about the wildlife or what else you want to talk about.
Well, I think I need to noodle on this and figure out what I can do. But I like the idea of doing something for both kids, and we'll have to figure out how. But that's
sure.
That's a different conversation than this one. So, all right. Well, again, thank you so much. I'm going to let you run. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks a lot. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll put links to Luke's previous appearances on today's show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/191. I'll also add a link to Nelson Nash's book on the show notes page, which is a link to, of course, to Amazon. As I was editing this episode, a question came to me, and so I asked Luke, if I take a loan for the full amount of the policy, does the policy still compound interest? He said yes, and I suppose that was pretty easy to figure out, but it's good to know. I'll add Luke's website to the show notes page also. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you taking time to listen. And thanks to my Patreon supporters as well. Please share this episode on your social media feeds and rate and review the show on your favorite podcatchers. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.